difficult to become impervious to physical suffering, because as she said, I think I have no depth, I have quite an indifferent attitude now. But as physical suffering still, you know, I get very upset at times. My mother-in-law has been suffering since last 6-7 years. So how does one overcome that?
You know, physical suffering is certainly the most pressing pain. Other pains are easier to come out, as you rightly said, by psychological treatment of our own consciousness. But physical pain is the most difficult thing. And this will take time. We have to give time to overcoming this pain. And the more we are able to allow the higher force to penetrate into the body, our own body. And that is a very difficult task to allow. First of all, the body has to be kept in contact with the divine more and more. To allow the atmosphere to remain as peaceful as possible. That's the first condition. Although the life is full of hustle and bustle and noise all around, we actually live in a marketplace all the time psychologically. Therefore, to allow the consciousness to remain as peaceful as possible, like here now, for example, the peace of the divine is quite great in this room. And to be in such a condition for a long time, until the body itself begins to feel the presence, not only psychologically, but the body itself, the vibrations in the body, the vibrations of peace and calm and peace and silence and so on. The more this happens, the greater is the penetrating into us. First is the peace is the easier thing to have normally. Our first experiences of the divine are more or less those of peace and silence. They are much more easier. But as you move forward, a positive gladness arises. And in every condition that gladness is sustained more and more, there is an inner cheerfulness. Under every circumstance, that cheer remains. And then there is a positive delight even in every circumstance. If I'm insulted, I don't feel offended, I feel delighted. If I fail, I do not feel depressed, I feel delighted. Not that I welcome insult, not that I welcome failure, but my condition is such that I derive from it the real rasa. And my consciousness perceives that something else is being worked out through this experience. As Mother once said, humiliation is the sure gate of glory. Normally, humiliation is something which people try to avoid and they don't like it. But Mother said that if you really want real glory, not that you invite humiliation, but if it occurs, then it can open up in your life a gate of glory. So, if you realize this, not only intellectually, but in your state of presence of the divine, because when divine is present all around, it is always the invasion of Satchidananda around you. Now, the more you live in this condition, the more you remain free from suffering, even if it is suffering of somebody else. And the more you can help even the suffering individual to receive a similar peace and delight. In fact, this is the best way of helping others. Normally we console people by words, by remaining together and so on, which is also all right, but that is not the effective method. The effective method is if we can carry within ourselves that vibration of peace and delight. And then even if you are with somebody for a short time, you can impart it more easily. And that gives a great strength to the suffering individual. So the more we live in state of peace and delight, the more we carry with us, the more we are able to help the others.
For the person who brings the humiliation, I tend to feel very sad for that person also. Maybe if I'm the object of humiliation, but the person who's inflicted it, I feel very sad.
Yeah, that is good. That is a great sympathy, which is good. As I said, it is not that we invite sorrow. It is not that we invite defeat. It is not that we invite humiliation. But if it happens because of circumstances and by the various situations in which one is placed, then these very things open up a gate which otherwise would not have opened at all. There is a secret meaning, as Mother said, it is only in the night that the greatest secrets are revealed. It is in the night that the greatest secrets are revealed. Now, there is a scheme in the world. So those people who feel, oh my Lord, I'm in darkness and I'm in the night. But then the whisper of God comes more readily when you are in the night. It doesn't mean that during the day it doesn't come. But the scheme of the world is such that some of the most important things, some of the best things can occur when there is defeat, when there is insult, when there is humiliation, when there is night. The scheme of the world is such because you're going into the night means that you have dared to enter into that very field where God has to manifest fully. So somebody should go to that plane and you have dared. So naturally the divine is closest and gives you the best help at that time.
But in ignorance, as you're saying, in the night or in defeat, in ignorance, don't we aggravate the situation in a defeated
state? You do, because that is why we do not know how to take a defeat.
But that doesn't help you or elevate you. In fact, you are further degraded because of...
Because we take it wrongly, that is why. Just as success also leads to degradation if one becomes extremely proud in success. This is the wrong way of taking success. The whole point is that all experiences have to be taken in the right manner. You have to see the message involved.
But for that, the basic
ignorance... Not basic ignorance. Ignorance is not something like... one uniform piece. It is a kind of a degradation in the ignorance. If one is totally ignorant, you have become insensitive. So there is no problem. In a total ignorance, there is only insensitivity. So nothing happens. Whether you succeed or fail makes no difference. Even the experience of success or failure, even awareness of it, means that your ignorance has slightly diminished. Now, if you diminish it further, then you are able to deal with it properly. In fact, actually, if you see retrospectively all your failures, if you really measure it, you will find that all the failures were really the doors to success. Retrospectively, if you rightly examine your life, truly...
Is that a universal truth? Does it apply to everybody?
Everybody. Actually, this is the truth, because fundamentally, the scheme of the world is that you are to walk. The whole world is nothing but walking. That's why it is called Jagatyam Jagat. It is Jagat. Jagga means Gaman. So, walking and walking, that is the whole meaning of the world. So, we are all walking actually. Our entire delight is nothing but walking. Now, as we walk, we pass through many, many sceneries, many, many gates, which are locked. They are closed. And we are supposed to open the gates. When they are really blocked, we are prevented from walking. So when we are prevented from walking, we feel pain, suffering, depression, etc. Because we are not able to walk further. So when you stand at the gate, which is locked which is closed, you try to knock. Now normally we don't know what is to be done. We don't even know that knocking is necessary. That is why Christ said, knock and the gate will open. It's a very simple thing actually. But normally we don't know that this is so simple as that. That actually do not be depressed, do not feel disconcerted. Just knock. And simply say open. It will open. It is so simple as that basically. Now intellectually it's very easy to say all this, but actually to do it at the right time in the darkness, sometimes you don't even see that the door is locked. You may be before a door, you can't move forward, but you don't know there is a door which is locked because there is so much of darkness. Therefore it is even more difficult to say how you open. Don't even know how to knock. So you have to gradually by standing, by groping, you find out that this door is locked. And then you simply say, now open, sincerely, it will open. So, in a certain sense, you might say the world is very easy to cross. You are just supposed to walk. And go on walking, walking, walking. That itself is delight. Walking, we are here all for a walk. And we are all together walking together. It's a picnic, you might say. We have come from the camp of God and we are going to another camp of God. In the middle, all this is a process of walking. And in this process, because it's a good picnic, there are all kinds of hideouts and then you have to, somebody is concealed, somebody is knocking and somebody is trying this way, that way. But it's a real picnic actually. And then you go on walking, walking and doing all sorts of games. Because life is nothing but a game actually. And you play various kinds of games. And the greatest game, as Sri Aurobindo says, is of hide and seek. So this is all that is happening. You go on moving forward. And then you reach the other camp and there is also delight. So here there was delight. And if you take walking as a delight, it is delight. And there also there is a delight. So it looks very simple and very, very straightforward, but because of ignorance, we do not know what is to be done, we do not know where we are, what we are doing. It is like children who do not find the mother who is hidden or deliberately is hidden. But mother knows all the time that the child comes to trouble, she is there to take him. There will be no problem. So it is so simple, basically the whole scheme of the world is quite simple. But because of our ignorance, we are in trouble. In fact, what Sri Aurobindo says about the Bhagavad Gita is precisely this when he says that there are three things in the Bhagavad Gita which are of greatest importance. The first is the divine teacher about whom we spoke last time. The second is the human disciple, that is Arjuna. And third is the occasion of the war. And all the three are basically typical. The divine teacher that is spoken of in the Bhagavad Gita is the inner divine. The emphasis in the Gita is not upon Shri Krishna, the avatar who is speaking physically, but the emphasis is upon the inner divine who is always present in everybody's case. It is typical because the situation that is portrayed in the Gita is a perennial theme of the world and for everybody. When we are moving in this world, you can imagine that you are yourself in a chariot. And that the charioteer is Shri Krishna himself. Whether you know it or not, but it's a fact. The divine, the eternal avatar is already always there around us. It was not only that Arjuna was so privileged that he had Shri Krishna with him and therefore his problems could be resolved so easily, but the same situation obtains with regard to every one of them. That is why Sri Aurobindo and the mother said they read the Gita as though the divine teacher is in you. And wherever Shri Krishna says, I am there, I am this, I am that, it is the inner divine of whom Shri Krishna speaks. Now, Arjuna also is a typical human being. There is a difference between the two words, symbolic and typical. Some of the parables of the Veda Upanishads are symbolic. And many times it is said that even Bhagavad Gita is a symbolic story. But Sri Aurobindo says that the Bhagavad Gita and Mahabharata is not a symbolic story. It is a typical story. There's a difference between symbolic and typical. A symbol is some figure which stands for something else. When you say, there is a flow of the river in my mind. Now, flow of the river in the mind is symbolic. It only means that just as the river flows with ripples and waves and currents, similarly there is a divine consciousness which also flows like currents and waves and waves. Now, in the case of a parable of Indra and Kutsa, which you find in the Veda, this story where Indra fights in his chariot along with Kutsa, who is also with him, and during the fight Indra meets the adversary forces, kills them, and comes to conquest. In the meantime, Kutsa, who is in company with Indra, becomes himself like Indra. And when he reaches the home of Indra, it was difficult for people to distinguish between Kutsa and Indra because both looked alike, except Shachi, the wife of Indra, who could make a distinction between the two. Now, this story, Sri Aurobindo says, is symbolic, not typical. In the sense that in this story, Indra stands for the Lord himself. And Kutsa stands for somebody seeking the divine light. Now, how the seeker of divine light himself becomes illumined by accompanying the symbol of the Lord, Indra is symbolic. Kutsa is symbolic of somebody seeking the light. So this whole story is symbolic of one particular kind of experience that one can have when one you really have great seeking of the Lord. Now, such is not the case of Arjuna and Shri Krishna. Arjuna and Shri Krishna's being in the chariot together is typical in the sense that It in every human being's case, one can regard oneself as Arjuna, and one can always find Sri Krishna to be with you because the divine is seated within you. Let us take the example of some of the dramas that we might have seen. Take the drama of Hamlet. It is said that Hamlet is a typical story. Every human being who arrives at a certain intellectual level in a state of innocence, of relative innocence, and when that person's innocence is broken or shaken, blown by a very shocking experience, then disbalancement will take place. As a result of that, the kind of things that Hamlet does in the play, a human being normally begins to do. Now, this applies to the type of situation that can exist in the world quite often. So Hamlet is supposed to be typical. Macbeth, for example, is a typical example of a man of ambition. A human being who was so obedient and so faithful to his master, Duncan in this case, suddenly hears a voice from three witches, "Hail King," giving the impression to Macbeth or injecting into the mind of Macbeth an ambition which was not there at all. But this ambition is injected into the mind of Macbeth, and once that injection takes place, he becomes possessed by that ambition, shares it with Lady Macbeth, and she also becomes attached to that ambition, and then goads Macbeth to realize that ambition, to such an extent that both of them plot, make a conspiracy. They invite Duncan for dinner, and when Duncan was asleep during that time, Lady Macbeth goads Macbeth to go and kill Duncan so that after his death he can immediately pronounce himself to be the king. Now, Macbeth does not symbolize something. Just as in the case of the flow of water is a symbol. It's not that Macbeth is a symbol of somebody else. But what happened to Macbeth can happen to many human beings. A certain type of human being can become capable of receiving that injection. Not everybody. Not that everybody can be inspired to have ambition. But certain type of human beings, they can become suspect, they can become so weak as to receive the suggestion, and something which was not there before in their heart, in their consciousness, they become possessed with it. King Lear again is a typical example. The father who has tremendous attachment for his daughters and wants to give everything to his daughters, wants to make them happiest. And then he gets disillusioned, becomes frenzied and mad. It's also a typical psychological condition of man. There are types of human beings who can become affected in this way. Othello, again, is a typical example. Not a symbolic example, but a typical example, that when a person is in love with his wife so deeply that he can become a victim of jealousy of somebody else who can inject into him a terrible poison so that he becomes burning all the time with fire of jealousy and begins to suspect his faithful wife and ultimately murders her. Now these are typical frailties of human beings. And these examples show that human beings are of this type or that type or that type or that type. If the Mahabharata were only a symbolic story, we might say that Kauravas stand for evil forces and Pandavas stand for good forces. And read the story in that symbolic manner. So you might say there was no such actual war at all. It is only a symbolic story. And how to symbolize good forces and evil forces? So a fiction was created by Vyasa and said that, well, Pandavas represent the guru, the good forces, and Kauravas represent the evil forces. And the whole story can be read in that way. And some of the people actually, when they interpret the Gita, they tell you that actually there was no question of war. Arjuna is only a kind of a symbolic human being. There was an occasion when Arjuna actually stood in the battlefield and he saw the Pandavas on this side and Kauravas on that side and became depressed. According to this symbolic interpretation, Arjuna himself is symbolized as having two forces within himself, good forces and evil forces, in his own consciousness. And the whole battle that is shown in Mahabharata was simply a battle going on between the two forces. And Arjuna is a symbolic figure. In symbolism, the thing that is described never happens. But it is a method, a kind of a figure which is created to express certain inmost things. It's a kind of a literary method of presentation. Symbolism or figurative language is a method of expressing certain things which you cannot directly express otherwise. When the Veda says, for example, cows were born in my mind. Cows are born in my mind. So this is a symbolic language. It's not typical because there is no actual case where cows can really be born into the mind. So you cannot say this is a typical thing. It is symbolic expression. Cows stand for light. The word cow is symbol for light. So instead of saying light was born in my mind, it says cows are born in my mind. And that's why Veda is very difficult to understand, because unless you know the symbolism, you can't make it out as to what it means. So many people try to show that Mahabharata is a symbolic story, that Bhagavad Gita is a symbolic story. But Sri Aurobindo says that actually if you read the Bhagavad Gita and Mahabharata, if you merely treat it as a symbolic story, it is so difficult to stretch every time symbolism. In a symbolism, whatever is symbolically presented should be actually fitting in it. Like the rivers flowing in my mind. Now, real river and the consciousness when it flows have a real comparative value. Now similarly, if you say that Mahabharata story is nothing but a story of evil forces and good forces coming together, that if you read the whole story, you won't be able to sustain the symbolism at all. It is a typical story, you might say, that there are occasions in human life, in human story, where such situations do arise physically, not symbolically, they do arise physically. And Mahabharata is therefore a typical story. That is why you have a film like Kali Yuga, where Mahabharata story is typically shown, as if the same story which was in Mahabharata with other characters, but the same kind of, there is a typical Draupadi which is shown here as Draupadi, and there is Arjuna which is also shown as Arjuna here, and so on. The same brothers and so on. Such a thing is typical in the sense that what happens at a given stage is typical of similar situations can arise, which can arise in the world at many times. So Arjuna is a typical figure in the Bhagavad Gita. In other words, there are types of human beings in the world which fit into the description that is given of Arjuna. Now, Sri Aurobindo explains what is the psychology of Arjuna, which typifies similar human beings who can be in the world. And the interest of Arjuna's character is that most of us fulfill that type of Arjuna. Most of the human beings in the world are in a sense similar to Arjuna. Therefore, the story of Arjuna fits into our life quite easily. Now, what are the characteristics? In fact, the whole chapter called The Human Disciple is written to describe the nature, the psychological nature of Arjuna. The divine teacher is already shown to be the internal avatar, whereas Arjuna is a kind of a representative man with certain typical characteristics. And Sri Aurobindo now points out that this typical character is first of all sattvic in nature, but subject to all the three gunas. That's the first statement about Arjuna. He is sattvic, not because he is totally sattvic, because in whenever human beings normally are neither one or the other absolutely. There is a mixture of three gunas all the time. He is fundamentally a man of the mind, a mental being. But among mental beings, there are three basic types. There is a rational mental being, there is an ethical mental being, and there is an aesthetic mental being. Anybody who reaches the stage of mind development, there are three types.
The sattva, which fundamentally is the characteristic of the mind. Then somebody is legislate very much, that means mind is not very much developed. One is either tamasic or rajasic. When the mind begins to develop, the sattva also begins to develop. Because what is sattva? Sattva has two fundamental characteristics. One is light, and another is delight. These two characteristics are very peculiar to sattva. Anybody who is sattvic in temperament has a natural liking towards knowledge. And there is always in that consciousness some kind of harmony, some kind of delight. Not the supreme delight, but some kind of delight which constantly goes on vibrating in a sattvic consciousness. If you notice children, for example, it can be very easily found out that sattvic children are very often misjudged by their parents because they are not so-called smart. The rajasic children are often smart. They are very dynamic and bubbling and moving about and courageous and doing this, doing that. They can never rest. The sattvic boy or girl remains very quiet, basically, because there is inner harmony. This quietude may also sometimes be misunderstood as promising, because there is some kind of commonality between inertia and the lack of movement, and this harmony where also there is a lack of movement of the ordinary kind. But whether the inertia is tamasic or it is sattvic can be determined by the fact that sattvic consciousness is in search of knowledge, but not a rajasic search of knowledge. In a rajasic search of knowledge, one goes about breaking, opening, this, etc., in a very great rush. But a sattvic mind is quiet, considering, looks at the things from many points of view, and opens the doors of knowledge very quietly, very seriously, sincerely. But his tendency is to discover knowledge. And there is an inner delight. This is how you can distinguish between the sattvic child and the rajasic child. But as I said, in sattva, or at the mental level, there are three kinds. The sattvic has three kinds. The rational, ethical and aesthetic, predominantly. Now, a rational sattvic person is a thinker, is a philosopher, who is in search of truth as distinguished from appearance. The aesthetic mental man is in search of beauty, creativity, and experience. The aesthetic personality is a pursuer of experience, as distinguished from the sattvic rational personality, which is in search of thought, not experience, but of thought, of knowledge, in the form of thinking, of conception. The sattvic moral personality is in search of doing good as distinguished from doing evil. This is the fundamental drive of the sattvic moral man. Now, Arjuna is cast in this particular mold. He typifies a moral sattvic human being. As I said in the very beginning, predominance is the one that distinguishes one from the other. But otherwise, all the three are present. The human nature is actually a great mixture. There is nobody purely sattvic without rajas and tamas. No purely rajasic without sattva and tamas. No purely tamas without having some rajas and some sattva. That is of course understood. And yet by virtue of predominance of one or the other, you can make a distinction.
So what I meant was the ethical, the moralist.
Okay.
The overlapping of these three roles.
Oh yes, similarly, just as in the case of sattva, rajas and tamas, there is mixture. Similarly, every mental being basically begins to think. The question is, what kind of thinking? The purely mental sattvic being who is rational has a special kind of temperament, which is scientific, philosophic, and which pursues knowledge for the sake of knowledge. That is a special characteristic of a sattvic rational being. The moralist may also seek knowledge, but his question is, what is the use of that knowledge in practice of good? So tries to equate knowledge immediately with action. A philosopher may not be so very eager immediately to implement his knowledge into action. Ultimately he may do, because ultimately there is a personality which combines all the three together. At a higher level, the rational, ethical and aesthetic, all the three can meet together. Although there are still conflicts even among these three personalities. In fact, the science of personality becomes complex because of the fact that at different levels, different harmonies obtain, but not complete harmonies. Some kind of harmony arises when there are gaps in the personality, there are conflicts of personalities which still remain to be resolved. Even in the developed aesthetic personality, which combines the powers of rationality and ethicality, some predominance of one or the other may remain for a long time, depending upon the line which he has pursued so far. And you will see that the aesthetic tends to give less importance to the questions of morality, tends to give less importance to the debates of appearance and reality. Very often the aesthetic man is tired of attending the philosophical debates. So he's a moralist. A moralist also, whenever he attends a philosophical debate, very often will say, what is this all trouble unnecessarily? You tell me what is the really, ultimately what is your conclusion, and then let us put it into practice immediately. This is his fundamental drive. But the rational man says that to arrive at the truth, you require a long, long practice of understanding, gathering data, which requires a long time, and don't be in a hurry. So a philosopher thinks that a moralist or an aesthetic man, they are unnecessarily in a hurry. They don't have the patience to find out the truth. They simply want to grab the truth and say, now let us know immediately how to apply it. This is a special characteristic of these three personalities. Only when you have developed ultimately some kind of harmony, then you can have human beings who are all-rounded. But even at that level, you cannot integrate them. You require a further development, the psychic development, spiritual development, because sattva, rajas, tamas and rationality, ethicality and aesthetics are really reconciled in the psychic and the spiritual. So when the personality becomes more and more psychic and more spiritual, you become more and more integrated. You cannot really have integration without psychic and the spiritual. That is the necessity of it. It is not as if you develop psychic being as a kind of a luxury. It is not something like an option given to you that you may develop, you may not develop it. If you like, you may develop it. But at a certain stage of development, it becomes a necessity. You cannot reconcile them. Let us take the example of Hamlet once again. What is the combination in the characteristics of Hamlet? It is a characteristic of a philosophic mind which has a very high dose of moral tendency. A philosophic mind which has a high amount of turn towards ethicality. Aesthetics is very little in his personality. But these two elements are quite developed. A philosophic mind, actually he was a student of philosophy. In his university he was doing philosophy. A philosophy student, one who is turned to philosophic thinking, but turned towards the good. Now this personality suddenly comes across an experience where his thinking is shot, his moral sense is shot. It is a double shock to his thought and to his ethical sense. When these two are blocked, and he doesn't know how to overcome this conflict. If he was a complete thinker, he would have withdrawn completely into solitude or quietude and would have thought over the problem that he was facing in a very patient manner. If he was only a philosophic mind, then this would have happened. But it's not merely philosophy. The profound question that he asks, for example, to be or not to be, that is the question, is a representative of a philosophic mind. But the fact is that he is not able to think either very deeply. He raises the question, but he doesn't have the patience to think out the whole question. Why? Because he immediately wants to do something. He wants to act, and act rightly. If he was just a rajasic personality, he would have murdered his mother and father immediately, his uncle immediately. If he was only that, he would have not even questioned whether it is right or wrong. But he was not sure, first of all, whether to be or not to be, that was the first question, and what is the truth about it. He was not really sure that really his mother was a conspirator in the murder of his father. He was not sure whether his uncle was a partner to the conspiracy. He was not sure. And he said, if I'm not sure, how can I do something wrong? Now it is there that he was blocked. The whole tragedy arises from this fact. If he was not a philosophic mind, if he was simply like Hamlet, like Macbeth, Macbeth had no philosophic mind. Macbeth does not typify a philosophic mind. He typifies only a man of morality, a man of action, and not even sattvic man. He was actually a vital man, but with some tinge of morality and of ethicality. So he was a faithful man to begin with. But when the ambition is injected into him, he becomes subject to the vital impulse. If he was a philosophic mind or something much more than that, Macbeth's tragedy would not have arisen. Because of his ethical sense of good and an ambition put together, there was a battle in his life. A tendency towards ambition to be fulfilled and a tendency to do the good thing, to the right thing. The entire tragedy is a result of these two tensions. And ultimately he does it. And once he does it, he doesn't mind at all the boundaries of morality. He goes on the whole spree of killing thereafter. The vital being altogether takes him over. That shows that he's a typical human being who is slightly risen to the level of ethicality, but still subject to the temptations of the vital being to such an extent, to rajas to such an extent, that ultimately the ambition can overpower him and make him do the terrible action of killing the very man of whom he was a faithful servant. And then the resultant tragedy takes place. So when these different aspects of personality begin to develop in a certain manner and not yet fully reconciled, then the resultant is that in the transitional period, crisis arrives. If Arjuna was a very rounded personality, in which rationality, ethicality, aesthetic, spiritual, higher domains, all would have been conquered, the crisis would not have arisen at all. It is because his philosophic mind was at a lower level. Because his ethical mind was at a higher level. But that higher level of ethicality was not at the top of it. And this is also to be noted. Arjuna was a practical, pragmatic, emotional, ethical man. These are the special characteristics of Arjuna. He was pragmatic or practical. He was emotional. He was ethical. But ethical, not guided by philosophical thought. There are people who are ethical, like Socrates, for example, was at once ethical and philosophical. He had thought over the problem of the good and the evil leisurely on a long canvas, as it were. He had walked the path of thought on good and evil. And that is why when he was charged, he did not come to a crisis. When Socrates was brought before the tribunal, Meletus began to put questions to him. He was not at all ruffled. He knew what was good. He knew that he had come to the conclusion that this is the good. He had known the whole path of philosophical thought, as a result of which he had concluded this is the right thing, this is a good thing. And he took even the imprisonment knowingly, consciously, without a crisis. He went to the prison, began to discuss with his disciples as if nothing has happened. And he was talking philosophy and teaching philosophy even in this prison room. Even when the jailer came and said, I will give you a secret passage to go out of the jail, he says no. He was sure it would be wrong to do it. There was no doubt in his mind. It is not as if he considered for a day and said, no, ultimately I have come to the conclusion now that I don't want to escape from here. There was no crisis at all. And ultimately he faced, even when the poison was given him, hemlock was given to him to drink, he takes it very lightly and says that, well, after some time you just go on seeing my limbs one after the other. And when you come to the heart and when you find it is cold, then you realize that my heart has stopped and I have gone. Now, this is the simplicity with which the whole thing happened without crisis. It is because his philosophic nature and his ethical nature were very developed. So there was no conflict on that account.
The thinking, the contemplation, what
you're... Yes, a thinking is of three levels. First is thinking based upon ordinary observation. Observation is a starting point of real thinking. There are many other kinds of thoughts which arise directly from our emotions, impulses. They are also called thoughts. But the real thinking, real philosophic thought arises on the basis of the data which are presented and observed. So there's a first starting point. Even in science, for example, observation is a starting point. Observation, experiment, formation of hypothesis, verification of hypothesis, confirmation, repetition. These are the steps of scientific thought. Similarly, in a philosophic thought, observation of facts of life is a starting point. But normally you do not have all the facts before you when you start. So it is gradual building up. You observe many facts. You encounter many experiences. But during the time when you are investigating, your mind is observant. It's a specialty of a philosophic mind or a pure scientific mind. Developing an observant mind is the fundamental condition of rationality. One who is purely ethical and not philosophical, he has no patience to observe. He is very impatient to do something and do something that is right. But if he has not arrived at this conclusion philosophically, what happens to him is that he tends to accept authority of higher people who simply tell him this is right, this is wrong. And as soon as he knows this is right, he immediately starts doing it. Because the tendency is to do the right. As far as finding out whether he's right or not, he depends upon somebody else whom he believes, whom he trusts. So most of the ethical beings in the world are those who are not philosophical. And these people tend to accept the word of a master, injunction of a friend, whom he considers to be much more developed, or injunction given in a book, or a shastra, or even if he attends a debate on the subject, his whole attitude is to come to a conclusion as soon as possible. There is impatience to do the right thing. So the process of arriving at the idea as to what is good, he wants to do it as quickly as possible. If he was also philosophical at the same time, he will spend time in thinking and will stop or resist his tendency to act immediately. And this is what happened to Hamlet, because he was philosophic in his mind, so did not immediately jump into action. He allowed some time to think out, even to verify the doubt that his mother and uncle were conspirators. He made a plot of enacting a drama in which the whole conspiracy of which he had learned and about which he was not sure, he got it enacted just to see the reaction of his uncle and his mother while watching that drama. So you can see how much he was considerate to the demands of philosophic truth as to what exactly is the truth he wanted to find out. So he took so much of trouble, otherwise he would have murdered his uncle very easily when he was in a prayer room and Hamlet is just there and he has got full chance of killing his uncle just at that time. But he doesn't, because he's not sure whether it is right or wrong. In the case of Arjuna, you cannot say that he had no philosophic training at all. He had. But predominantly, he was an ethical man. He was predominantly an emotional man, predominantly a practical man. Therefore, sensations, emotions, practicality, and ethicality, these were the fundamental forces of his life. And if you read the whole of Mahabharata, you will find confirmation of this description of Arjuna. Sensational, emotional, pragmatic, ethical. But ethical not philosophically. Ethical in the sense that he was prone to accept the truth or good as declared by dharma or dharma shastra or philosophers or the sages or great men. The crisis of Arjuna arises because a situation arises in his life where this kind of personality cannot answer the questions which arise in that situation. That is the crisis. All crisis is a resultant of the inner abilities or inabilities confronting the demands of a situation. And when the equation is disbalanced between the two, that is to say, the force that you have to deal with the situation is less powerful, less capable than the demands of the situation, then one is put in a crisis. This was a situation in which the kind of ethicality that he was pursuing so far had no answer to the questions which now arise in that situation. In every human life, we find the questions of right and wrong almost at every step. what is right, what is wrong, we normally know, as it were. And therefore the life goes on smoothly. It is easy to tell the child, read, because you think reading is good. Isn't it? Because we think it is good, therefore we say read, and therefore we have no doubt in the mind at all that you have given the right advice to the child. No question, no crisis. Go to sleep early. You are quite right. You are sure this is the right thing to do, and therefore no crisis at all. But when the child reads properly, when the child sleeps properly, and yet the child is not happy, yet the results are not commensurate to your expectations, then you begin to wonder what is really right and what is wrong. A question really arises when you really expected results don't come about. Then you begin to ask whether your handling of the child is proper or not. Now, this is an ordinary kind of a problem in which you may perhaps find an answer more quickly after some reflection, after doing this or that, making this effort or that effort. By trial and error, you find out some kind of a workable formula. But there are situations when you can't find the answer at all. Then the crisis arises. On the one hand, when you must solve the problem, on the other hand, you can't solve the problem. When these two things confront each other sharply, then you call a situation of crisis. Till that time, your situation is that of a problem, not of a crisis. As long as you have got elbow room where you can swim further, it's a problem. But when you can't, when on one hand you must do it, on the one hand you cannot do it, then there's a crisis.
And doesn't this crisis arise out of, because you don't understand what it means to you?
Yes, quite right. Yes. Absolutely. The situation that is before you, you are not able to face it, and you are not able to face it because of three reasons. You don't understand it, or even if you understand, the force opposed to you is very powerful and you do not have the means of meeting it. Or thirdly, even if you have the power, you are restrained. Even if you understand, even if you have the power to deal with it, but somehow you are restrained.
You don't have the means of doing it.
You are chained, as it were. You can do something. For example, there are human beings who are addicted to liquor. Now, some of these people know what is to be done. They have capacity of doing it. But liquor disables him to do anything. He's chained. He cannot do it. Then the crisis arises. So, in any case, the general definition of a crisis is a situation where you must do and you can't do. And the two confront with each other with a tremendous pressure, then you say, I'm in a crisis.
But in that case, isn't it the fact that his willpower is, you see, there's a conflict between imagination and willpower. Imagination will always win. And that's what's wrong with him, really, isn't it?
It may be, it may not be, necessarily. The different individuals have different combinations. In a given personality, you cannot say that imagination always wins. Sometimes imagination is very often the cause of your failure. Because you can imagine very well, because you can anticipate very well, therefore you can't act very well. Action requires a certain kind of quickness. And imagination takes you away from quickness, therefore you can't act. So it depends upon different combinations. But the general point is that in any state of crisis, by whatever reasons, ultimately you reach a point where you must do and you can't do. This is the state which you can call is a state of crisis.
Then there isn't much time for a must do.
Yeah, that is either no time or anything.
Yeah.
There may be no time to do it, or there may be disability to do it, or there may be still a doubt in which you cannot do it. But crisis arises when you must do and you can't do. That is a general trend, general point about crisis. Now, in the case of Arjuna, his psychology being what it is, namely practical, emotional, sensational, and ethical. Ethical, which is not guided by philosophic thought, but ethical, which is guided by norms set by other people, which have so far worked very well in his life. But now he is confronting a situation where the two norms stand side by side and confronting with each other. In the past, there was only one norm to be followed, and there was no conflicting norm also at the same time demanding that you do this. Now, in his life, he has now come to a point where two norms, both equally good, and he could not decide which one of them to accept. Argument on this side, argument on this side, both were so powerful that he simply collapses. And even when he says, I will not fight, he still is not sure whether this is right or not, and turns to Sri Krishna and says, please tell me decisively what is right. And you will notice that when Sri Krishna discusses the problem, Arjuna shows impatience. And he says, you tell me quickly what is right. Don't confuse my mind. Decisively you tell me what is to be done and I will do it. Because he is not accustomed to that philosophic thought. Now, Sri Krishna, being a very great teacher, he knows that without a dose of philosophic thought, he cannot come out of this crisis. Not that he was troubling him. Not at all. He was very kind, very compassionate, but he knew that the remedy of his problem is to bring him to a state where philosophically he has to be brought out from his present grooves. Therefore, Sri Krishna began to speak to him of going beyond and attaining to the state of samadhi, to speak about the soul which never is dead, and all that sort of thing. And Arjuna feels very impatient.
Is that to give meaning to the situation?
Yes, he wants the immediate situation to be tackled. Instead, Sri Krishna went on doing something else, because Sri Krishna knew that his problem can be resolved only if he is taken out of this mentality which wants immediate solution. Because the solution cannot be otherwise given to him. So what is to be done? As a good doctor or a good teacher, he bears even the scolding of Arjuna when he says that, well, tell me decisively, why do you tell me mingled truths? Sometimes this, sometimes that. Why are you doing this to me? This is the typical human mind, which is ethical, which wants, pragmatic, which wants to do something, and which is not accustomed to a good philosophic debate. And Sri Krishna starts a kind of philosophic debate.
They are
all like that. Yeah, that's right. Sri Krishna says that Arjuna is typical. He tells us the typical story of our life, actually. So this is typical of all of us, actually. It is very few people who are prepared to discuss a problem with great patience until the highest and the ultimate is shown, and then ultimate is connected with the present situation. And Sri Krishna knew that the problem that Arjuna faces is so grave that unless he is lifted up first of all, this problem cannot be solved.
So is that the same as saying that the very fact that he can't give time to the problem means that he must give time?
Exactly. Precisely. Because he's also part of his crisis. Precisely. He can't give the time and he must give the time. That also was his crisis. And Arjuna was anxious. And that creates a lot of problem in his mind. So even when Sri Krishna goes on telling him, in the second chapter he scolds Sri Krishna. In the fourth chapter again he scolds and says, well, if you think that intelligence is more important than action, then why do you throw me into this Ghora Karma at all? But Sri Krishna really wanted to tell him that unless you go into that intelligence, first of all, you will not be able to solve your physical, your practical problem. So first of all, hear about intelligence. So Sri Krishna pours a good lecture on him about intelligence. And Arjuna, being impatient, he says that if intelligence is more important than action, then why do you want me to do this action at all? I think we can stop here now, because then we shall we shall go into the real crisis next time.
See? No, it's all right.
But this is the real problem of the Bhagavad Gita. Unless we understand the nature of this problem, first of all, the psychology of Arjuna, the tendency for him to do the good, and inability to seek out the philosophic or spiritual basis of good, and impatience arising therefore, is the fundamental cause of the crisis of Arjuna. On the other hand, the solution that was necessary at that time could not have been given without that great philosophical and spiritual upliftment of the mentality of Arjuna. Therefore, the difficulty for Sri Krishna as a teacher, and therefore he had to bear the questionings of Arjuna. Even when Sri Krishna says, what is samadhi, sir? Then his first question is, all right, this is all right, samadhi is accepted, but now tell me, how does he walk? How does he talk? How does he move about? It is immediately about action. Apply immediately to action. He is pragmatic. He wants to do immediately. All right, samadhi is accepted. All that you say is accepted. But now tell me, how does he act? So supposing I also go into samadhi, will my problem be solved? That is his real question. So all the time, this is his fundamental tendency. So we shall see next time, this real crisis, the real problem, where exactly his failure to apply the idea of good, which up till now had helped him, now fails in this particular situation. Just as a mother comes across the situation where all that she knows is good, she has applied to her, and now yet the child is facing a problem, then now what is that new knowledge that has to be given to the mother to be able to overpass that problem of the child? Similarly, here we have a problem. What was the good that he knew, which had applied in his life, as a result of which up till then he was successful? What is the new problem which has arisen now before him? As a result of that, there is a conflict between one good and the other good, which had never come in his life before, this kind of a conflict between one good and the other good. The conflict between two good standards. This also is good, that also is good. Then what is to be chosen between the two? What exactly was this choice before him, which he could not decide upon, as a result of which, mama gatrani shithilani bhavanti, all his limbs become absolutely feeble, and he throws away his gandiva. So we shall see that next time, because if it was a short thing, I would have said immediately, but it is rather a long thing. It will require at least 1 hour to expound this particular crisis. All right.